So welcome to this last session of the colloquium. The first talk is given by Thibaut Brunet from Institut Pasteur, the evolution of animal cell motility. So I'll stand up after 25 minutes.
After 25?
Or? After 25 minutes, I'll stand up there.
Perfect.
Quietly.
Thanks to the organizers for this very nice invitation, and thanks for everybody to everybody for being here. So I will tell you about the evolutionary origin of animal cell motility, and notably about the evolutionary origin of crawling, and more particularly about what we can learn about it from a group of organisms, which are called the coenoflagellates, which are the model organisms of my lab in Pasteur. So very briefly, if you've never heard about coenoflagellates, one way to justify their study is to consider the diversity of animal life. And so this is a fairly typical first slide for an evolution talk, showcasing the diversity of shapes in the animal kingdom. And what I want to emphasize instead is, in this case, what all these animals have in common. So one thing they all have in common is that they're all multicellular, they're all made of many different cells, they all have different cell types, and they all have a controlled shape, which is established by a process of morphogenesis in embryonic development. And that implies that if you now consider those animals in an evolutionary context, so this would be the group of animals in the evolutionary trees, they all come from a common ancestor. And all the features these animals have in common, including what I just mentioned, the multicellularity, the cell types, the morphogenesis, some particular tissues like epithelia, and some molecules like wind, HOX, BMP, FGF, which are important in development. All of these features likely date back to the last common ancestor of all these animals, which implies that the last common ancestor was already a fairly complex organism. It already had some version of all of these features. And another important point is that other multicellular groups you might be familiar with, such as fungi, social amoebae, or plants, all evolved multicellularity independently of each other and independently of animals, which means that if you want to understand how this complexity first appeared in the line that led to the last common animal ancestor, you have to consider their closest neighbors in the tree of life, and notably their immediate sister group, so what is so their closest living relatives, which is a group of organisms which are called the coenoflagellates. And coenoflagellates are aquatic microorganisms which have a number of important features for understanding animal origins, including facultative multicellularity, some degree of cell differentiation, and even some genes that were thought to be specific of animals, including cadherins, integrins, even delta notch. So if you've never seen a coenoflagellate, here is one. As their name indicates, they are flagellates, so they have an apical flagellum exactly like a sperm cell. But they also have an additional feature, which is a ring of actin-filled microvilli around the flagellum, which form what is called the collar. So the collar and the flagellum together form what is called the collar complex. And this collar complex is fundamental to the life of coenos in two ways. First of all, the beating of the flagellum allows the cells to swim around exactly like a sperm cell, but it also creates a flow that carries bacteria that are being eaten by the coenos and which serve as food. And coenoflagellates are characterized by this collar complex, and we know now pretty much for sure from molecular data that they are the closest living relatives of animals. But that close relationship had been suspected actually all the way back to the 19th century based on morphological similarities. And in particular, if you look at the distribution of this collar complex I just mentioned, you would see that if you consider now the animals, a lot of animals have cells that have a collar complex very similar to coenos. And the most obvious are probably this branch here, which are the sponges. And sponges, so here you see a coeno again with its collar complex. Sponges have cells which are called coenocytes, with which they phagocytose bacteria, which function exactly like coenos and which also look exactly like coenos. And that similarity was what led early naturalists in the 19th century to suspect a close relationship. And later, often thanks to electron microscopy, this type of collar cells were actually discovered more broadly in the animal kingdom. You would find them in cnidarians, for example, in sea anemones. They often serve actually as mechanoreceptors with a ring of microvilli around the flagellum, very similar to a coeno. And you even find cells in our own body, in the human body, which are plausibly interpreted as modified collar cells. And the most illustrious example are the cells with which you're hearing what I'm saying right now, which are the hair cells of the inner ear. So they have a staircase of stereocilia, which is actually a misnomer. Stereocilia are microvilli, which are deflected by sound waves and which end in a kinocilium, which is a modified cilium. And in fact, in both development and evolution, hair cells emerged from modification of an ancestral collar architecture. So this close similarity in cell architecture and this close evolutionary relationship have given rise to what is maybe the most common textbook account of animal origins, which is the flagellate hypothesis, which starts with a colony of some coanoflagellate-like unicellular ancestor, which then became more extensive and eventually evolved cell differentiation and evolved notably what I mentioned, what I'm going to talk about from now on, which is cell crawling. And so this flagellate hypothesis of animal origins can be traced back to a Ukrainian biologist from the late 19th, early 20th century, which was Elie Metchnikoff. So Metchnikoff was originally a comparative embryologist, what we would call now an evo-devo, or an evolutionary developmental biologist. And he was the first one to propose that animals had evolved from something like a coeno. And Metchnikoff has become extremely famous, but for another reason, which is that he also made an important contribution to the discovery of the function of cell crawling in animals. And what he's most famous for is actually the discovery of innate immunity, which is the discovery of phagocytes. And so the story goes that one day that his family was gone at the circus, Metchnikoff observed a starfish larva, and starfish larvae are extremely transparent, so you can see everything that's going on inside. And as I mentioned, he was interested in marine invertebrates, in comparative embryology. But he noticed those cells that were extremely mobile inside the starfish larva, and he had the intuition that maybe they were patrolling the body and clearing intruders. And so he immediately wanted to test it, so he took what he could to injure this unfortunate starfish larva, which turned out to be a thorn of a rose from his garden. And he was extremely excited to see that indeed mobile cells, phagocytes, rushed to the site of injury to phagocytose intruders and debris. And so that was the beginning of actually Metchnikoff's side project originally, which was the discovery of innate immunity, which is what he's remembered for now. And actually Metchnikoff was maybe a bit predisposed to thinking about cell crawling, in part because before that he had also described its function in development. So he discovered in his monograph about jellyfish development, he discovered gastrulation by ingression, in which cells move inside, dissociate from the epithelium and move inside the body and form the endoderm. And so you can appreciate here, so this is the original drawing, that Metchnikoff was a lot of things, but he was not a great artist. So I think even I could draw that. I really cannot draw. But nonetheless, the description was in essence correct, and it's been confirmed. So you can see here the gastrulation of Icora, which is a jellyfish that GFP happens to come from. And Metchnikoff's account was essentially correct. The cells ingress, and this is how gastrulation happens. So Metchnikoff made these two big contributions, in a way. On the one hand, the flagellate theory of animal origins. On the other hand, this realization that cell crawling is ubiquitous, very important for development, very important for immunity. And the way he actually reconciled the ancient existence, in a way, of these two phenotypes, the crawling cell phenotype in animals and the flagellate phenotype, which is a bit more like a polarized epithelial cell, if you want, is by assuming that cell crawling had evolved in a very narrow, very precise window in animal origins, which was after multicellularity, while back when everyone was still a flagellate, but before the last common ancestor of all surviving animals. So it evolved very early on, just after the flagellate colony, or at least that's Metchnikoff's scenario. And so, of course, Metchnikoff's first assumption that crawling is widespread and important in animals is still considered true today, and we've seen a lot of examples during this meeting already, including the crawling of neutrophils, so immune cells. You would find those in cnidarians, you would find those all the way back to sponges. You see here a sponge crawling cell just close to a coanocyte, and of course, also in embryonic development. So you see here a chick embryo, so similar to what Francis discussed yesterday. So this widespread importance and probably ancestral existence of cell crawling in the animal kingdom is widely supported. And so evolutionarily, if you think about Metchnikoff's scenario, it poses a bit of a paradox, because if you assume that crawling evolved from scratch in animals, then it's a bit surprising that a lot of single-celled organisms, even though not coenos, do have cell crawling, which is very similar to the one you see in animals. And of course, the most famous example are the amoebae proper, the amoebozoans, which include, for example, Dictyostelium. But you would find it even in some early diverging fungi. So early diverging fungi still have a flagellum. They're still unicellular. And they can also crawl around. And you would also find it in these intermediate groups between fungi and animals in the tree of life. So you can interpret, if you assume coenos have no cell crawling, you can interpret that distribution in two ways. The first, so that's, you know, the diversity of coenos as it is known today, and they, you can see that there's variations. Some are unicellular, some are multicellular, but they all have this flagellate architecture, which is very stereotypical and unrecognizable. And this is actually, this species here is the other main topic of the lab that I'm not going to talk about today, but which is a coeno colony, a species named C. flexa, which we discovered 4 years years ago now, which is capable of rapid spectacular shape changes. So this is one of the things we study, the collective behavior. But you can see that a constant across this diversity of coenos, which have more than 400 known species, is really this flagellate architecture. So there is actually one exception to this broad conservation of the flagellate architecture in coano, which was a single report back from 1882, so that's extremely old, by a British naturalist named William Saville Kent, who claimed he had discovered a coano colony which had flagellated cells in the periphery and amoeboid cells in the center. And he claimed he could see interconversions between these two phenotypes, so it was very exciting because it looked like a coano colony which had the beginning of spatial cell differentiation, so in a sense, a new level in the evolution of multicellularity. Nonetheless, as exciting as it was, this observation could never be confirmed. Saville Kent was accused of several things during his life, including murder. So this... I'm not kidding. It's still debated, though. So for that reason, that observation is considered somewhat suspicious of uncertain reliability. And so in the sense, this distribution of cell crawling in the tree of life raises two possible explanations. The first one is the one that Metchnikoff essentially envisioned, which is that, okay, maybe cell crawling is ancient in eukaryotic evolution, but before animals split from coenos, it was lost, and animals re-evolved it entirely from scratch after multicellularity. And that seems a bit unparsimonious, but a lot of zoologists and evolutionary biologists have actually subscribed to that. The alternative would be, of course, that cell crawling was conserved from single-celled ancestors and that coenos simply lost it. And in a sense, there would be an incomplete model for the single-celled ancestor of animals, which is absolutely possible. So this story starts with an accidental observation that came from my postdoctoral work in Nicole King's lab in UC Berkeley, which came from live imaging of the most common coeno model species, which is called S. rosetta. And in some live imaging sessions that I was doing for other reasons, we could observe that some cells seem to spontaneously switch to an amoeboid form. And I'm now playing the movie, and this is sped up many times. But you can see this coano is doing something very strange. It's retracting its flagellum, it's scattering its microvilli, and it's extending protrusions. So it starts to look a lot like a very canonical amoeba, and you would never recognize that as a coano if you saw it in the wild. So at first, it was not clear what induced this switch. It seemed spontaneous. After a while, we realized that there was actually something we didn't know in the culture medium, which was some degree of evaporation. So simply, the coano were possibly being trapped into a smaller and smaller film of liquid until potentially they were confined. And that, of course, made a lot of sense as a possibility, because confinement is well known as a regulator of crawling in diverse eukaryotes, So the pioneering work came notably from the lab of Mathieu Piel and C.P. Heisenberg, and also now Verena Ruprecht, in which they showed that confinement of mammalian and zebrafish cells triggers a switch to fast amoeboid motility based on bleeding. But confinement has also been found as an inducer on crawling in more distant eukaryotes, including chytrid fungi that I just mentioned, so those unicellular fungi. This is from Liane Fritz-Lehlin. So she could show that if you confine them, they start crawling around using lamellipodia, which was unknown before. And it's also been found, for example, in Dictyostelium, and that's the work of Nishit Srivastava. And of course, Dictyostelium always crawls, but depending on whether it's confined or not, it's going to crawl a bit differently. It's going to use blebs and contractility in high confinement, while in low confinement, it uses lamellipodia. So in a sense, it seemed logical that confinement might induce a switch to a crawling phenotype, even in coenoflagellates, which are not supposed to do that. And it also made sense for another reason, which is that coenos are known to exist in naturally confined interstitial environments. And notably, there is a type of environment called the silt, which is like sand, but which merges smaller grains. The order of magnitude of the pores is from 2 to 50 microns, so that's small enough to conceivably confine a coano, which is about 5 microns large. And in fact, the main model coano species, which is S. rosetta, has been isolated not from the ocean and not from the water, but from a mud core in an Atlantic island, so really from an interstitial environment. So in a sense, it was not absurd to think that coanos might be adapted to navigating this type of packed, confined microenvironments. So then, once the hypothesis was out there, the obvious next step was to impose controlled confinement onto the coenos, and we used the hydrostatic system that was with micropillars that was developed in Mathieu Piel's lab. And we found, indeed, that if you do that, S. rosetta becomes totally amoeboid, and it extends protrusions, it retracts its flagellum, and it becomes essentially unrecognizable as a coenos. And that actually is a very fast switch, which takes place in about 10 seconds only. And we could show that it nicely correlates with confinement height. So if if you confine below 3 microns, so more or less slightly under the order of magnitude of the size of a cell body, so enough to significantly deform it, then the coenos start extending bleb and starts switching to this amoeboid phenotype. So this observation raised 3 questions. The first one was, okay, why do they do that? Does it have a function? What is the mechanism? How do they respond to confinement? And then, does it mean anything for cell phenotype evolution? If you think about these Metchnikoff-like scenarios, do we need to amend them based on those observations? So the first question is, okay, what is the function of this switch? Why do they do that? And one important thing to note is that this is an entirely reversible process. And you see here a population of coenos that's being confined, and these have been stuck with polydilysin, so they cannot crawl around at all. They don't crawl very well anyway, but those really cannot do it because we prevent them. And I will jump a bit ahead in the movie, and you will see that when we, so these become amoeboid. If we reverse confinement, so we are now reversing confinement, you will see that very, very quickly the flagellum start growing back. And the cell body starts becoming, you know, a bit egg-shaped again. And so the collar will regenerate, and that's not so fast. That takes maybe 20, 30 minutes. But then the coenos completely come back from the amoeboid switch. So this is a completely reversible behavior. It's not something that's killing the cells or damaging them irreversibly. And so that suggested that the amoeboid switch could conceivably be an escape behavior. And to test that, we made them face an interface between a confined environment and a non-confined microenvironment, and to see if the cells would be able to crawl through it and maybe become flagellate again. And you will see this is exactly what happens. So the analysis was done by, the segmentation of the cells was done by Marvin Halbert in the University of Zurich, and you see here the result. You see that this cell basically, I'm going to play it again, as soon as it detects this interface, seems to crawl directionally and to elongate until it's crossed completely. And I want to emphasize that this is slow. They crawl slower than a micron per minute. So they're definitely not professional amoebae, but still they manage to escape. And in fact, this is a very consistent thing that coenos do whenever they face this type of interface. If you measure the orientation of crawling and you plot it in a rules plot, you see that indeed they polarize very strongly toward this interface until they've completely escaped and until they can become flagellate again. And if you quantify the shape of the coenos, now if you measure the aspect ratio, so it's a measure of elongation, you can see that as long as they're confined, the aspect ratio is low, they're pretty much circular. As soon as they've crossed by chance the interface with the non-confined environment, they elongate, and they remain elongated until they finally managed to escape into the non-confined world. So in a sense, this can be interpreted really as an escape response from confined microenvironments. And that can be interpreted in 2 ways. The first one is, I mentioned, the silts. And you can assume, so this is from a piece that Catherine Avell and Leanne Fritz-Lehlin wrote about our work. You can imagine that if you're in a silt and you get confined by a local compression of the silt, for example, then one possible response is to escape and to become flagellate again. So that's one interpretation. But another interesting possible natural environment for this switch is actually the attack of predators. And we know that coenos, of course, have a lot of predators, which are other microorganisms that can phagocytose them. Sometimes it includes other coenos. And I'm going to show a movie, which is another species of coeno, where you see here this very large cell, which is sessile, which will attempt to phagocytose another coeno, which is swimming. And you see that I always find it slightly scary to watch, even like the phagocytic cup is growing around this prey coeno, and it responds by apparently contracting and by escaping back into the water. And so in a sense, another source of possible confinement in nature might be simply the jaws or the phagocytic cups of other microorganisms, including potentially other coenos. And I was also reminded of that actually when seeing a recent paper in eLife that Julie Theriot, who's here, was a contributor on, in which they actually quantified the deformation of acrylamide beads being phagocytosed by macrophages. And if I play the movie, this is a phagocytic cup growing from the left to the right here. You can see that this bead is really being visibly deformed. So being phagocytosed is not just being passively surrounded by membrane, it's really being tightly squeezed. And in a sense, it would make sense that it would activate this confinement response and this escape response in a microorganism in the ocean. So those two interpretations are not mutually exclusive. There might even be other functions to this behavior. The next question is the mechanism of this amoeboid switch. One thing we wanted to solve early on was the nature of these protrusions, the extent. There are several types of protrusions that eukaryotic cells make. Phyllopodia, which are very thin, so we knew it was not that. But it could be either pseudopodes, which are filled with polymerized actin, like lamellipodia, or it could be blebs, which are formed by detachment of the plasma membrane from the actomyosin cortex under the effect of contractility. And we could show pretty conclusively that the protrusions of confined coenos are really blebs. And there are several sources of evidence. One of them is simply live imaging. So this is we can now generate transgenic coenos, thanks notably to the efforts of my colleague David Booth. And this is a coeno which has a live actin marker, fluorescent actin marker. It's confined, and you can see that these protrusions that form are first completely free of actin, and then actin reinvades them and it retracts them. So this is really the typical behavior of a bleb and not of a lamellipodium. And as an independent test, we treated the coenos with a number of compounds to see if anything could inhibit this switch to an amoeboid form, and we could find that blebistatin, which is an inhibitor of actomyosin contractility, very reliably inhibits this switch to switch to an amoeboid form on this generation of protrusions. And finally, we also generated a strain with tagged myosin, fluorescent myosin, and we could show that blebs, when they form, are first free of any myosin. Though you can see one here, like in the DIC, and you see that in the myosin channel, you don't see anything. But with time, it gets reinvaded by a cortical myosin and cortical actin as well, and it gets retracted. So it's, there is some cortical myosin close to the blebs. It's first absent from the blebs, but then it retracts them. So that's the typical behavior of a bleb, as it's been described in animal cells and also in dictyostelium. So this is consistent with this behavior, in a sense, being ancient and homologous across these different branches. One very open and unsolved question is, what is the nature of the pathway that detects confinement and triggers the switch? There is one that's known from vertebrate cells, again from Mathieu Piel and Verena Ruprecht and their collaborators. And what they could show is that actually in vertebrates, the sensor of confinement is the nucleus. And the nucleus is a little bit squeezed. It triggers unfolding of the nuclear envelope, and it activates a protein called CPLA2, which is actually a phospholipase. And together with calcium, CPLA2 activates actomyosin contractility. And this is what makes vertebrate cells become amoeboid when they're confined. Interestingly, we know this cannot be true in coenos because, first of all, they don't have CPLA2. It appeared only in a subset of animals. You find it all the way back to cnidarians, but even sponges don't have it. So it's an innovation that appeared during animal evolution. And if you deprive coenos of calcium, which is necessary for this pathway to function, interestingly and at first disappointingly for us, but maybe also intriguingly, the amoeboid switch on the bleeding activity is completely unaffected. And you can deplete external calcium with an external chelator. You can add a cell-permeant chelator to remove internal calcium. You can put both at once. They don't care at all. The bleeding happens completely normally. So one of the things we found is that we don't know the mechanism. One of the things that are intriguing that we found recently is that the reorganization of the cytoskeleton during the amoeboid switch is actually pretty extensive. And I just mentioned that you can see in the live cells cortical actin while they're blebbing. But if you look at coenoflagellates while they're not confined, while they're in their normal flagellate form, you see here an immunostaining with tubulin in green, you see the flagellum here, and actin in magenta, so you see here the microvilli. This is a SIM super-resolution microscopy which we generated at the Pasteur facility a few months ago. You can see actin in the microvilli, so that's normal. But if you look for cortical actin, you pretty much don't find it at all. And in fact, the flagellates have a tiny bit of cortical actin sometimes, often close to the collar, but most of the time they have very little or nothing. And that contrasts, of course, with what we had seen with the amoeboid cells in live imaging. So just to make sure we compare apples to apples, we did some stainings of cells that had been confined or not. And this was the work of an Erasmus student in my lab, Maite Freire Delgado. And what she observed is that if you stain a population of coenos for cytoplasm and F-actin, if they're not confined, you see actin, you find actin in the flagellum. You find a tiny bit in the cortex, but it's variable and not all cells have it. If you confine the cells, everybody gets a very strong and thick and recognizable cortical actin cytoskeleton. And you can actually observe the same thing in 3D. Again, in SIM imaging, if you compare a flagellate coenoflagellate, that you see here, it has a little bit of cortical actin, but not too much by going through this stack. But if it's confined, you will see below, actin is here, so there is a very, very strong cytoskeleton of cortical actin around the entire cell that forms within seconds in response to this confinement. So there is something like a switch of global cytoskeletal organization from a flagellate mode, where you have cortical microtubules but not much cortical actin, to an amoeboid-like cytoskeleton with a lot of cortical actin. And one of the questions we want to solve is how this, this actually forms. So I will very quickly talk about the evolutionary significance of those observations. We could show that this switch is conserved in several Koenos species, so it's likely very ancient in the evolution of Koenos. This is consistent with the idea that the amoeboid phenotype dates back to the last common ancestor of animals on Koenos, so in a way we think this is a conserved phenotype that had been missed in Koenos simply because people were looking only under, including ourselves, under standard culture conditions and had not tried different things like confinement. So this is consistent with it being an evolutionarily ancient feature, and in a way the somewhat frustrating situation I described in the beginning is no longer as frustrating as it was. In the maybe 1 minute left, I want to mention that under confinement, under intermediate confinement, 3 micron, we actually discovered that there is yet another mode of mobility that Koenos can do, which is flagellar gliding. And so they can use their, you can see some cells here that move around very quickly. It's about 10 micron per second. It's much, much faster than the amoeboid crawling I described earlier. And we could show, based on some preliminary data, that what happens here is that the flagellum is capable of gliding and of propelling the cells under intermediate confinement. So there are at least two modes of locomotion in Koenos that we didn't know about that were discovered thanks to these confinement. And I will just end with a movie in which you see an illustration of this flagellar gliding that we are now intrigued by, a Koenos that's been confined, and you will see that the flagellum is capable in some conditions of detaching from the cell and continuing on its own. So that's a clear illustration that the flagellum can glide, and we are, of course, very intrigued by that. And with that, I will acknowledge my postdoc lab, my current lab. These are the papers. If you haven't understood anything I said, you can read about it. But if you still want to know, of course. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much.